The Angie's List you know and trust is now Angie, and we're so much more than just a list. We still connect you with top local pros and show you ratings and reviews, but now we also let you compare upfront prices on hundreds of projects and book a service instantly. We can even handle the rest of your project from start to finish. So remember, Angie's List is now Angie, and we're here to get your job done right. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I, or download the app today.
Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Hi, guys.
Hey, everybody.
Happy Pride Month to everyone out there, including John.
That's right. It's Pride Month. I'm waving my metaphorical pride flag here with everyone listening to the show.
This episode that we're covering today, and we've teased it on another shot, and it's a really important episode. But as I've told the listeners before, that we have an agenda in front of us and points that we want to hit, so we make sure that we're factual in everything that we're talking about. And the first point on here is, of course, because we're asking if Matt's here, is Matt isn't here today because, and I quote John on this one, we've banned all straight people from the show this week.
That's right. Except Megan, who's, of course, not really on the show, but she is in the background keeping things. And, like, we like Megan.
We enjoy Megan. And Megan is, like, she's gay adjacent.
That's
because,
true.
She has cats. She does our show.
She does Rock Horror Picture Show.
Exactly.
Yeah. But
who did you say I was in Rocky Horror Picture Show? Like the Hamburglar? Who the fuck did that was?
Megan's on mute and probably cackling right now. Megan,
I hope so.
Jump on, you can. You would be definitely Frankenfurter.
Frankenfurter, right.
Hamburglar. Yeah.
Okay. Megan, I think that you should add in Hamburglar to the show and let me play it. What do you think, Megan?
I think you should absolutely be the Hamburglar. I think you would be excellent.
Thank you so much. Thanks so much. I love all the support in Pride Month. It feels good. It feels good.
Yes, absolutely. And Matt is actually not here, but we'll be back, I think, next week. He just, of course, was just busy being a dad, I guess.
Are you drinking anything today, John?
I'm not at the moment, only because, like I said, it's just harder because we record these shows, when I have a lot of other things going on. I'm not trying to get, like, tipsy and then, be working at the same time. So nothing for me today, which I think I just need to be better about this moving forward. I'm going to go to the liquor store sometime.
You need to be better about, I'm not going to say drinking and driving. I'm saying drinking and working here. You need to be about doing your work under the influence. I think we could all use that skill in our lives in quarantine.
Absolutely. I love that.
I'm drinking. I switched it up slightly today.
Yeah.
And I am drinking a screwdriver.
Ooh.
Yeah. A little orange juice and a little vodka. Nice. It's not one of those drinks where you can have like 10 of them. It's one of those drinks that I just like to have. It's a good summertime drink. It's humid here in New York today. It makes me feel refreshed.
Yeah.
I'm getting my vitamin C because I'm not going outside as much to get my vitamin D. So I'm just trying to get all my fucking vitamins at once, along with the vodka, of course. And it's quite refreshing. So cheers, bitch, to all
cheers, bitch. Yes. I do have some water here. I'll cheers to that. How about that?
Yeah, can you clink the glass or something? Because I'm in a plastic cup. I don't really get
too.
Drinking.
Here, I'll just do a clink for fun with like, just for the, just for the audio.
The effect of it.
There we go.
I really miss our soundboard that we had that we got like a month before quarantine where I could hit the random buttons. I'm missing it.
You were really good at that too, by the way.
By the way, you haven't gotten any notification of being back in the office or anything, right? There's no update there.
No, No, not really. You know, I think New York numbers are really good, but I think, you know, there's still, our company is still, Darren's company as well, you know, still just weighing the options as far as I've heard. So,
true.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, better safe than sorry for sure, but I can't wait to get back in the studio and hit all the buttons to annoy me.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's why we want to get back. We got to hit those buttons.
you know, before we get into this week's episode, John, just going now more the serious tone, because I know that you had mentioned that you wanted to address it. We teased it on the shop, but I kind of want to give you the floor here because you are, you know, Mr. Harry Potter. Not that that's I don't true. Have my own opinion about this, but the J.K. Rowling controversy, which really has been in the making now for a couple weeks, and she came out with some quote-unquote transphobic statements. And I say quote-unquote because there's controversy about the statements within it, so I'm just trying to respect people's sides. But I'm wondering if you can walk us through it now that you've had a little time to research it and what you came out on it, really.
Yeah, well, I think, you know, I don't want to put any words into her mouth, so if you guys listening want to see what she said and have your own thoughts about how she presented it, you should go to her Twitter account where she has pinned everything so that everyone is very clear about what she said. you know, to sort of paraphrase it a little bit.
Sure.
You know, it's, well, not even paraphrase, I'll just give you the sentiment around it. I mean, she said a lot of things that are transphobic, that are hurtful to trans people, that are stereotypes and stigmas against trans people that they've been fighting for and we as allies have been fighting against, rather is what I should say, against for a long time now. And, you know, I just, yes, I had mentioned it a couple of weeks ago. To be honest, I knew that we were going to probably be doing the Marsha P. Johnson case, which I will just let you know, I've produced entirely for today's episode. So
yeah, you did.
Yeah, thank you. And I was already working on it, so...
You're telling me if it's bad, then I can't blame Matt, or can I still blame Matt?
Well, you should still blame Matt for that.
Okay, cool.
Yeah, that's how that goes.
Can you clarify, though, exactly? When I was reading what she was saying, I think she was talking about how she was talking about sex not being real, right? Which really isn't the issue, because gender's the construct. I don't think anyone's arguing that sex isn't a real concept. Am I right about that?
Yeah, I think you're hitting that right. To be completely honest with you, I have a hard time interpreting her exact point with all of this.
Me too.
You know, back in December, she tweeted about, and I don't want to make this all about J.K. Rowling, so I don't want to spend too much time here explaining her, but in December, she made some points that basically asserting or insinuating that trans women are not women because they were biologically not women, therefore they should not have the same rights as a biological woman. And that set off a whole frenzy of things, including
a
new
acronym. That should be rights, yeah. Sorry.
Yeah. Yeah. No, yeah, I agree. And by the way, of course, Darren, please weigh in however you want. I just wanted to comment myself, especially about J.K. Rowling, but I don't want you to feel like I'm on the
floor. No, you probably are better educated you're educating me. Let's put it that way.
Well, maybe, I don't know. But, you know, in December, you know, this term TERF became a somewhat mainstream thing that I had never even heard about myself. And it is to reference a trans-exclusive radical feminist is how it's explained. And it's sort of the subset of, and by the way, I'm not saying I subscribe to that term necessarily myself. It's just what people are, you know, kind of using in the mainstream. And it's sort of the subset of feminists, particularly women, who are very, very feminist and all for the women's movement, but they exclude trans people because they are not biologically women. Therefore, they do not subscribe or should have the same rights as biological women. So it's very, it's a very weird conversation because most people who would be very progressive or compassionate about feminist issues, there is the subset of people who think that certain people, particularly trans people, should be excluded. And I'm getting a note. Thank you very much, Megan. It's trans exclusionary radical feminist, not trans exclusive. My apologies there.
Yes.
But essentially, that's the gist of it. And I think it came back up at the, you know, I don't even know how this started, to be honest, at the beginning of June with J.K. Rowling. I find it very odd. She's, you know, continuing this conversation during Pride Month. I think it's kind of hurtful in that way. She's made a couple more tweets. And then after that, in fact, right before we started recording a couple of weeks ago, she released a 3,000-word essay explaining herself and in some ways pointing fingers and explaining her own personal circumstances with what she perceives as trans people. I mean, it's very, very, very complicated. But the gist of it remained the same, which is that she feels that trans women are not women and should not therefore receive equal rights as women. And in the UK, it's a very different story than what's happening in the United States. There are a lot of, I think, court cases and laws being made around this right now that are very relevant to what she's talking about. And it's not a UK scenario. Obviously, trans rights are worldwide rights, but what J.K. Rowling is talking about seems to be a little more focused, I guess you could say, in the United Kingdom. I just want to make a point here very clearly that I think, just like Emma Watson, who played Hermione Granger in all the Harry Potter movies, she tweeted, "Trans people are who they say they are," which I thought was such a great statement. I completely agree with it myself. Many other cast members, including Daniel Radcliffe, of course, who played Harry Potter, came out against her opinions as well. I feel disappointed. I think so many of us who love J.K. Rowling feel disappointed in what she's saying. It disregards trans people and kind of only views them as people with mental disorders, which really bothers me because, of course, that's what people thought about gay people decades ago. And, of course, still some people think this today. It's not a mental illness. There is, of course, gender dysphoria, which she brings up very, very often in this 3,000-word essay.
Well, gender dysphoria is a thing, though, right?
Or yes, of course. Like, I was just going to say that. It is a thing.
Yeah. Yeah.
She's sort of putting it on that
she's saying
every
it's
a, single
right,
trans
every,
person
right, yeah. is gender dysphoric.
Exactly, which is, of course, not the case. I mean, you know, there are a lot of... There's a great Twitter thread, if you go back through my Twitter feed, of a guy who is a scholar of some sort, maybe even works for some sort of trans pro-activism, who literally went line by line and refuted a lot of these very hurtful distruths that J.K. Rowling, for whatever reason, seems to be asserting as truth. And that's what really bothers me. It's almost like, okay, if you have the opinion, fine. Like, at least admit that you don't know what you're talking about, though. Because as a writer, especially, she should know the process for getting truths out there. She should know her place in the world in terms of, like, her influence. To write all of this 3,000-word essay and be so completely wrong about so many things just was so bothersome as somebody who has been such a huge fan of J.K. Rowling and her work over the years. And if you've listened to the show for a while, you know that I'm very vocal about my love for Harry Potter related things, as so many of us are. And so, you know, I think she needs to educate herself on the matter. She needs to not use her personal negative experiences in life as weapons against an entire oppressed community. There was even a mention at the end of that 3,000-word essay about her own personal sexual abuse that happened to her, which is, of course, abhorrent and terrible, and I sympathize and empathize with that. I'm sorry that that happened to her. However, that particular instance has nothing to do with the larger trans community of the world.
Mm-hmm.
To sort of use that as the ammunition, I guess you could say, and to weaponize, you know, her words against the trans community was very much a letdown. And I think that she just needs to really do what her characters in the Harry Potter books have done and lead with kindness and compassion. I mean, her characters in her books would not like her based on this, you know, this information.
That's a good point. Yeah, I don't really understand thinking that any person deserves any less rights than any other person.
Exactly.
I don't really understand the rights issue about it. I mean, we can talk constructs all day and maybe, you know, whatever, but to say that they deserve less rights, if that is in fact what she's saying, seems just full of hate and fucking ignorant and stupid. If that's what she's saying, then, and I just haven't read the whole thing. So that's why I'm saying an if
it's a
type
lot,
of thing, because I don't want to misspeak in anyone's words. To your point, I don't want to put words in her mouth, but anyone, no matter race, religion, color, whatever the fuck, sexuality, if you think anyone deserves less rights than you granted to us by the U.S. Constitution, come DM me and we'll have a very nice conversation.
That's good, Darren. Yes, Darren's DMs are open for anyone who wants to.
Yes, they are. And I have no problem talking to anybody who wants me to clarify on anything that I'm happy to say.
Well, I do want to. You know, I do want to say my friends over at MuggleCast, which is an amazing Harry Potter podcast.
It's great.
Yes. Andrew Sims, who is a very long friend, a great friend of mine, Laura Thompson, and everybody over there are doing a great job discussing these things. They've even done really great social media campaign, kind of refuting a lot of what J.K. Rowling has mentioned in this essay. Shedding light on trans truths, not the mistruth that she's tweeted, J.K. Rowling. Check them out at MuggleCast everywhere. And of course, just listen to that podcast if you love all things Harry Potter, like so many of you do. I know that's been a fun little like sub community of the Martinis and Murder group. You know, everyone that loves, you know, the Harry Potter group, you know, we're always chatting about stuff. But anyway, I just wanted to make that little like conversation, that little statement, and
I'm glad. Thank you for addressing it up at the top, because I knew certainly the listeners wanted to hear from you. I wanted to hear from you, and I appreciate you taking the time to research and give us your opinion on it.
And I don't want to say that I'm speaking for you, Darren, but I think in general you and I are on the same page about just, you know, what you just said. Everybody deserves equal rights, and that's that.
Yes, I mean, everyone, that's absolutely true. You are either human individual rights, and if you're a person, if you are a human being, you deserve any rights as any other human being, no matter where you come from and what you like. Should we get into the show?
Let's transition.
It's a pretty good, nice sequitur. Good job, John. That was successful.
Hey, I'm Jamie.
And I'm Justina.
And we're the hosts of Just So You Know, a podcast where we get to the bottom of suspicious stories and outright lies we're being told by companies that profit off of animals.
You think Elon Musk is shady? Wait until you hear our episode about his sinister brain experiments.
First he ruined Twitter, now he's coming for your actual brain.
No.
We've also got one about that time I stormed the runway at New York Fashion Week to protest Coach's leather handbags.
Yeah, I heard they weren't happy about that.
I couldn't tell you. They're not talking to me at the moment.
And we're just getting started. In the coming weeks, we're going to blow the lid off of everything from shady pet dealers to monkeys held hostage by coconut milk companies to the astonishing secret behind the no animals were harmed message you see at the end of movies.
And so much more. We'll hope you join us for this surprisingly fun journey full of strange characters, secretive companies, and a whole world of stuff they really don't want you to know.
Subscribe to Just So You Know wherever you get your podcasts and look for our new episodes every Thursday. Just So You Know is a PETA production.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
So if you're an LGBTQ plus, you know, if you're in that community or you're an ally of the LGBTQ plus community, you know, Marsha P. Johnson is a name that not only you should know, you're going to want to know, or it's a name you've definitely already heard of. We wanted to highlight Marsha and Black trans people because their murders have often been overlooked throughout history. We've seen this time and time again. And you know, Black people in general, people of color, any minority, those murders seem to get overlooked, but especially the Black trans community. It's just been horrible and ravaged with inequality here. And, you know, here are some details about why we wanted to really shed light on this, because in 2019, at least 26 transgender or gender non-conforming people were fatally shot or killed by other violent means, according to the Human Rights Campaign, HRC, as we'd be referring to it, which is an LGBTQ nonprofit advocacy group. Andy does a bunch of great things for HRC. I've donated to HRC before. So let me just give you a little statistics before we start off. So there's 26, right, transgender or gender non-conforming people. 91% of those deaths were Black women. 81% of them were under the age of 30. And 68% of them lived in the South. So that's a majority right there of being female, Black, young, and in the South. And since 2013, at least 139 victims of anti-transgender violence were people of color, including 122 Black and African-American people, 15 Latinx people, one multiracial person, and one Native American person. So this is tragic, and it's really horrible. And half of the fatal anti-transgender violence over the past 7 years has taken place in literally 6 states. Some of these states might surprise you. Some of them not. Florida, no surprise there. Texas, Louisiana, California, Ohio, and John, your state of Maryland.
I will say I was very surprised to see that Maryland, which is generally a progressive, you know, most people would consider it a blue state. In fact, a couple of these states are blue, including California. In that sense, you know, in terms of how they vote, you would expect maybe more progressive acceptance there. But, you know, I think, Darren, I think sadly, Baltimore, Maryland has the most instances of fatal anti-trans violence in the last 7 years, with 7 deaths. And the reality is there are a lot of urban kind of black and people of color communities in all of these states. And I think that's why, unfortunately, a lot of this is just my opinion, by the way.
Sure.
A lot of these things kind of are happening. I know Baltimore is very, very African-American and people of color. So, you know, you kind of have to think about like what's going on in each of these states. I was surprised also about California, but maybe it's just because there's so many people that live there.
It's a huge state, you know, it's massive. Right. And there's so many different types of places within California. And, you know, to your point about Baltimore, that actually has the most instances of fatal anti-trans violence in the past 7 years, with 7 deaths, according to HRC, which, you know, 7 deaths, I'm not overlooking that. That seems like maybe a small number in big picture, you know, when you consider, you know, 100,000s of people maybe dying from coronavirus or heart attack. But if you think about the community of the black trans community and how small that is in general, and then it takes 7 deaths in 7 years, I mean, that's a huge, huge issue that we need to be paying attention to.
Absolutely.
And in the vast majority of states, you know, there's no laws expressly banning perpetrators of violent crimes from asserting the victim's sexual orientation or gender identity as a so-called panic defense. So this is really interesting because Andy was actually fighting against this in New York along with the surrogacy bill, which we finally got passed. And
I didn't know that.
This panic defense, which is really an anti-trans bill, I mean, let's just call it what it is. But essentially, this panic defense, you know, allows a criminal defendant to argue in court that their discovery of the victim's sexual orientation or gender identity, so finding out that I'm gay or you're gay or trans or whatever, caused the defendant's violent reaction, which potentially leads to a reduced charge or sentence. So because they knew I was gay, they felt threatened. And therefore, it's a defense of them killing me or acting violently towards me. And, you know, when used in a case of violence against a transgender or a gender nonconforming person, this is often colloquially called a trans panic defense. Thankfully, though, in recent years, a number of states have enacted bans. California, Illinois, Rhode Island, Connecticut, Hawaii, Maine, and New York, thank God. The passage of such legislation will help to end the legitimization of violence against transgender and gender nonconforming people and ensure that victims obtain equal justice. You know, the interesting thing about this is, like, you know, what an odd defense that someone's either expression or how they identify or whatever we're saying here is enough to cause you so much panic and so much triggering that you have the right to be violent, because nothing about the way that I express myself, unless I'm waving a gun in your face or threatening your life, is cause for self-defense there.
I agree completely. And the idea that in a hypothetical situation, right, I can walk up to a person today, well, not today, but in these moments, and, you know, say, hi, I'm gay, and they can murder me?
Right.
Because they feel panicked about who I am is so bizarre and just frankly anti-American. I mean, it's, if you think about the Constitution and what our country was built on and the dream of America, so to speak, it just doesn't feel like there's a place for this in society. And thank God it's not.
Not only is it a shitty, stupid rule, but what about the reverse? You know what I mean? Like, listen, when I actually had my life threatened by a Southern fucking Baptist, does that mean, even if it was free speech, does that mean I had a right to kill her because I felt triggered? I felt my life was actually threatened. You know, like, what about the reverse in that? And of course, you know, we're living in 2020, John, and things do get better. And obviously, you know, there's no better time. As crazy it might be now, the world is getting better slowly but surely. And there's no better time to be a gay person, which is great. And none of this, you know, was even a kind of a thought at the time when Marsha was actually alive and living in New York City in the 60s, when it was way worse. So I want you to kind of get into that, you know, palette of what New York City was like then.
Yeah. And, you know, Marsha P. Johnson, we're going to get into a whole bunch of information about her, but her legacy was maybe unrecognized while she was alive. But today, in the year 2020, it's one that I think all of us should applaud. Marsha was born as Malcolm Michaels Jr. in August 1945 in Elizabeth, New Jersey. So think about that. 1945 is a long time ago.
Yeah, I mean, 75 now, you know? I mean, yeah. that's big.
Yeah, she was born in Elizabeth, New Jersey, was the fifth of seven children, according to the New York Times. Marsha became a staple of the New York City gay scene in the early 60s. After graduating high school in New Jersey, she moved to New York City with just $15 and a bag of clothes. Darren.
You know, every time I hear about, especially a lot of immigrant families, you know, coming to the United States with $8 in their pocket, not knowing the language, not knowing anything. I mean, I know Marsha was born Elizabeth, but just this idea of having $15, like,
yeah,
I don't know what that next step is, you know, right. to like get whatever you got to get. But that absolutely, it's so inspiring and it also terrifies me.
Absolutely. And I mean, not to be, you know, I obviously have a very different lifestyle, but when I moved to New York myself, this particular part just really spoke to me, because when I moved to New York, you know, it was during the last recession. Darren, we're living through a couple of recessions in our lifetime, you and I. But, you know, I didn't have a great job at the time. I had $200 in my bank account and a bag of clothes as well. And I just remember reading that and I almost kind of choked up, because I was like, wow, here I am. You know, that was 2012, and a very similar kind of circumstance, you know, just moving to New York City with a dream in mind and doing whatever you can. And, you know, not to sort of put myself in Marsha's shoes necessarily, but as a gay person myself, it was something interesting, you know, parallel that I liked in that moment.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, during her lifetime, the term transgender was not widely used. Of course, that is something more modern scholars, I guess you could say, are used as a reference. But she often referred to herself as gay, a transvestite, or just simply a queen, which I don't mind that. I like a queen.
And I know that transvestite, that term, you know, has sort of gone on the wayside. Thank God, yeah. You know, it's definitely derogatory. But certainly think about it back then, you know, 50, 60 years ago, it might have had less controversy around
it,
because
totally.
That's how she's describing herself, you know?
Yes, absolutely. I completely agree. It was not an easy time to be gay, as we have obviously mentioned. Even though New York State downgraded sodomy from a felony to a misdemeanor in 1950, the continued persecution of gay people and criminalization of their activities was very much common. I mean, imagine that. A felony? I mean, it's crazy to think how far we've come in since then.
Yeah.
You know, for example, same-sex dancing in public was prohibited, Darren, so you couldn't be out there with all your girlfriends, you know, twerking in the streets like you would be doing now.
Well, which I do all the time, but with a mask on this time. Yeah,
right.
It's fucking horrible.
And the state liquor authority banned bars from serving gay people alcoholic beverages. And in fact, in 1966, a handful of gay men, including Marsha's friend and roommate, Randy Wicker, who we're going to be talking about a little bit more extensively because he really plays a bigger part in her life,
yes,
challenged this ban by staging a sip-in. And so basically, bars that served homosexuals ran the risk of having their state liquor license revoked in 1966. I mean, that's kind of crazy in and of itself. Randy and the others were part of a group called, and I hope I'm saying this right, the Mattachine Society, mm-hmm, whose mission was to fight for gay rights in a time where there were literally none. Randy and the others entered Julius's, which is a bar that's still standing in the city.
Still been there. It's tiny, yep, as hell, but it's a great bar.
Yeah, they went in 1966, announced they were gay men, and ordered a drink, and they were, of course, denied service. But that's actually exactly what they wanted, a scenario to challenge so that the advocacy groups could take on the law. And History.com reported that Randy and others, quote, went on to two bars in search of rejection, Howard Johnson's and Waikiki. However, both establishments served the men drinks. It wasn't until they got to Julius's, a safe bet for rejection since it had been raided a few days earlier, that they got the response they needed to move forward and expose the discriminatory law, end quote.
Right.
So that was, you know, a great way to sort of protest and sort of get on the books that this law is out of control.
Yes.
But yeah, it wasn't just being served at a bar. People could be charged with sexual deviancy for cross-dressing. I mean, now you walk down the street in New York and you're seeing a lot of cross-dressing, whether it's for fun or, you know, how someone's identifying, or even drag queens if you're down in the village these days.
I mean, I think about myself and just in general as someone who, you know, I wouldn't say I cross-dress, but I'm saying, you know, I express myself in maybe a more quote unquote general masculine tone, yeah. you know, and I certainly was a tomboy. You know, why it doesn't seem to be the reverse. I mean, maybe it was, but especially right now, I think a lot of people look at this as men dressing as women being too feminine. You know, I'm curious about the other side of it. Is if I wore a suit like I wear to weddings, what would happen to me then? I don't know.
Right. Absolutely. I mean, yeah. it's crazy to think about. Police enforcement of homosexual crimes was seen as random, though. So there was no real telling about when people just living their lives was going to become sort of an illegal activity or not. And I think, you know, that's a really interesting point, in my opinion, because it really, I think, sheds light on the anxiety of it all. It's like, maybe, you know, 9 times out of 10, these people could go out and they wouldn't be bothered. But then that one time, you know, they're getting handcuffed and put in jail. So yeah, it's an anxiety thing that I can't even imagine living through. And people did it for centuries. And all these conditions, of course, added up to a monumental challenge for Marcia and how she identified and wanted to live her life. Susan Stryker, who's an associate professor of gender and women's studies at the University of Arizona, told the New York Times, quote, Marsha P. Johnson could be perceived as the most marginalized of people, black, queer, gender nonconforming, poor. You might expect a person in such a position to be fragile, brutalized, beaten down. Instead, Marsha had this joie de vivre, a capacity to find joy in a world of suffering. She channeled it into political action and did it with a kind of fierceness, grace, and whimsy, with a loopy, absurdist reaction to it all, end quote.
I mean, I got to be honest, this is a pretty great quote. And I think, you know, Marcia especially had every reason, every excuse in the book to look and act like a victim. You know, she was a victim, and to certainly just be beaten down. But to take it and sort of flip it on its head, you know, and make lemonade out of this really shitty fucking situation, I think it's just a testament to her character and to the movement in general, and how powerful and how we needed someone like Marsha P. Johnson to take to take those lemons, you know, and put it appropriately. And she had every excuse in the book not to do that.
Yeah. And I mean, the courage to stand up against literally the entire world. I mean,
yeah,
it's a very different thing now. You know, I've been in, you know, I remember the Equality March in 2010. I was a part of that. Way back, you know, it was an Obama administration 2 years into that, but it still felt like, you know, marriage equality was not really, you know, at our fingertips the way it ended up being. Obviously, all the transgender news that has happened recently and the progress that's been made there, that was not even on our radar in 2010. And I felt like it was such a heavy weight then. I mean, imagine being Marsha P. Johnson in that situation. Right. And standing up for what you believe in. I mean, it was a huge monumental pressure, I'm sure.
Absolutely.
Well, the people who knew Marsha the closest described her as a saint in some ways, and transgender icon Sylvia Rivera was best friends with Marsha and remembers Marsha as, quote, a mother to me, end quote, in the 2017 documentary The Death and Life of Marsha P. Johnson, which, by the way, you can watch right now on Netflix. And I watched it, Darren. It is really good.
Very, very powerful stuff. Yeah. I mean, you know, we're sort of given an idea of the bravery of Marsha, but, you know, she was more than just an essential personality in the New York gay scene. You know, she's a lot more to her. She was someone who looked to stand up for gay rights and transgender representation at a time where the word transgender wasn't even really a word. You know, no one really knew how to use it. And Marsha was an icon. She had an unapologetic personality who would just take to the streets and protest to her rights and for gay rights. Mm-hmm. A lot of the stuff that we're seeing today, especially with the Black Lives Matter movement. And Sylvia talked about the movement and what it took for her and Marsha to really stand up for what they believed in. And I want to say this quote right here, quote, we were the ones that stood the forefront and fought the cops off. And we're the ones that didn't mind getting our heads bashed in, quote. And I think as horrible as that is to say, that is the difference between sometimes a leader in a group and someone who isn't willing, because they're willing to take all the shit that comes with it. And that bravery really cannot and should not be understated, especially today. Carla Jay, actually the LGBT movement co-founder, also noted Marsha's place in the world, saying, quote, Marsha was very good natured. She was funny. She laughed. But that shouldn't be mistaken for a lack of serious purpose and political intent. End quote. You know, in a lot of ways, a lot of stand-up comedians, for example, they take a lot of their insecurities or things that they grew up with. I'm thinking Chappelle. I know a couple of minority comedians. And they take sort of the thing that hurts them most and they turn it into humor and they turn it to empower them. And I'm comparing it in a sense of like Marsha did that for herself and in this broader way for the community in general.
That's a very good point.
She took the thing that was probably her biggest vulnerability and the thing that mm-hmm. she knew that people could make fun of her for and bash her head in for, and it was quote unquote illegal at the time, and she flipped it on its head and really used it for that really good purpose. And I'm so lucky to be part of her community.
Yeah, I completely agree.
It's just, in a New York Times obit actually noted that Marsha's goal, which she spoke about in an interview for a 1972 book, was, quote, to see gay people liberated and free and to have equal rights that other people have in America, with her, quote, gay brothers and sisters out of jail and on the streets again. Fucking men. She also said, we believe in picking up the gun, starting a revolution if necessary.
Yeah, and you know, I'm so kind of sad, to be honest, in a sense, because I remember being at Stonewall, which we're about to get into, and how Marsha factored into that in 2015 when gay marriage had just passed days before this. And I just wish I knew more about Marsha at that time and could, like, you know, feel her spirit there, because she really was, in a lot of ways, the very beginning of this movement that took, you know, how many years is that? 50 some years to really come to fruition, you know? So that's just a little regret I have, just not knowing my gay history as well as I do nowadays. But
sure, absolutely.
Well, she was definitely a key person in the dramatic raids that happened at the Stonewall Inn, which I just mentioned, which is a gay bar in Christopher Street in New York City. Darren and I have partied there many a nights together.
Oh, yes, we have, with our other gay guy friend, Darren.
That's true. And some other people. And did I kiss a woman and a man that night? I don't know. Find out on another episode.
Find out never, because I barely remember that night. I'll tell you that.
That one night was
wild. Yes, right.
The most infamous, by the way, I should mention, Darren was not the woman I kissed, just in case anyone's speculating as we talk about things.
We made out heavily. We had
We made out heavily, right.
Exactly.
That was the night, by the way, that a guy comes up to me at the bar and buys me a drink. I'll tell you who it was, Darren, but he buys me a drink. We're talking for, like, I don't know, 20 minutes. He's super cute. And then one of our female coworkers walks up to me and she's like, oh, you've met my husband. I was like, really? At Stonewall of all places?
Yeah. That makes sense.
After we record.
Yeah, tell me.
Yeah. Well, anyway, the most infamous police raid happened on June 28th there in 1969, which is, of course, exactly 51 years ago to the day that this podcast is being released.
You gotta love good timing on this one.
Good timing. I love that. I love that. Well, according to the author Martin Duberman, who wrote the book Stonewall, 13 people were arrested simply for being gay at a bar. I mean, imagine that in 2020. Yeah. It's crazy. The book also notes that 4 officers were injured and that nearly everything inside of Stonewall Inn was broken or damaged as a result of the discriminatory raid. Also noted in Duberman's book on Stonewall were the other severe injuries that happened that night, saying, quote, one protester needed stitches to repair a knee broken by a nightstick. Another lost another lost 2 fingers in a car door. Witnesses recollect that some of the most feminine boys were beaten badly, end quote. So it really is a great example of the, you know, the prejudice and the discrimination. It was like the quote unquote feminine boys who quote unquote appeared to be the most gay, you know, were the target of a lot of these raids, unfortunately. And so, yeah, of course, that repair to the knee is especially terrible for me, you know, thinking about my knee problems recently, if you've been listening to the other episode.
I was just thinking the same thing, John. I was just thinking the same thing.
And though many people do consider Marsha to be the first person to throw a brick in this uprising against police brutality, you know, there are some conflicting reports about this. According to the New York Times, there's a lot of research about this because, you know, it's an interesting detail. Marsha was definitely there. We're going to get to that in a second. But was she the person who threw the first brick that started the movement? I don't know that there's really a solid evidence of anybody who can clarify.
Prove that, but I do like the metaphor of it. You know, I think no matter what, even if she wasn't that first one, she really was the first person to throw that first brick. And I just mean that in a metaphorical sense, you know?
Good point. Take a drink, Derek.
Oh, I will.
Marsha seemed to be just one of the many people at Stonewall that day who resisted the police during the raid on the bar, according to author David Carter, who wrote the book Stonewall, The Riots That Sparked the Gay Revolution. Sylvia Rivera, who we had mentioned earlier, Marsha's best friend, remembers the moment the police began the raid, saying, quote, "We were dancing, my lover and I. The next thing we know, the lights came on. We were being raided. Queen started being filed out and being put into police cars. Guns had been drawn. Molotov cocktails were flying. And I'm like, oh, my God, the revolution is here. Thank God." End quote.
Wow.
You know, what you were just saying about Marsha turning a negative situation into something positive, I think Sylvia just did the same thing. You know, here's this moment in history that could be extremely traumatic for Sylvia, but she recognized that it was going to be a bigger thing than it was.
Yeah, and I think that is a collective feeling. I think even now, you know, a lot of people are talking about how even when Eric Garner died, Tamir Rice, even Trayvon Martin, like, even though there were protests then, and there are certainly people talking about it, this time feels different, you know? And I think that's kind of what Sylvia is talking about. You know what I mean? As scary as it is, it also, it's like, this is the moment to capitalize and to seize, and it's their moment for the taking.
Absolutely. And what we haven't really mentioned is this wasn't the first raid. The New York City police were doing this often for a very long time. And this was the moment that they decided to fight back. And that's really what started this whole movement. Of course, it sparked and began the gay rights movement that many of us are still fighting for and speaking out for today. The first gay pride parades were formed in the years following the raid on Stonewall as a message of solidarity. Today's pride parades in the U.S. are still a message of protesting our rights and equality, but also a celebration of how far we've come as a society. Even in the last decade there, and like I said, you know, I was marching in Washington in 2010 for my rights, and look at what we have today, 10 years later. But of course, these pride events and parades are a little bit different in other countries where LGBTQ issues are a little more evolved. I wanted to mention this because we do have international fans. LGBTQ issues are not just, you know, specific to the United States. Let's
put
it that
way. Not at all.
And I actually have a very good friend of mine named Julian, who's a transgender man. He is from Germany and has lived in Finland and now lived here in the United States, in Boston and New York City. I actually got some quotes from Julian because I was curious about what he thinks about this stuff. Yeah. And I was like, you know, tell me about your experience. Like, how do you perceive American pride versus, you know, European pride in some ways? And he told me that in Finland, when he lived there, things were a little bit different, saying, quote, "It was different in Turku, the fifth biggest city in Finland, which has two universities, so a pretty young population. They were against the commercialization of pride," which, Darren, I find very interesting.
Yeah.
I mean, New York pride is very commercial. Saying, quote, "So no company floats throwing free stuff to the crowd. It was also much more political in terms of speeches, events through Pride Week, etc. Some people complained it was too trans-focused. It was organized by a non-binary person. So now they have LGB Pride and Trans Pride on separate weekends, with Trans Pride being very political," end quote. Yeah, I was very surprised to hear that it was sort of a separate thing.
Yeah, interesting. Yeah.
So Julian also told me that a big difference in Pride parades in Germany and Finland is that neither have politicians marching. And I'm thinking, you know, I'm thinking back, I don't know of any specific politicians, but I'm sure there have been some, especially in New York, that have marched in parades. It's something I want to look into, but I just find it interesting that they really keep that even separate. I had also asked Julian how he felt about pride and parades in general, given that sometimes transgender people feel, I think, I left out of the conversation. And he said, quote, "Pride as a trans person, it's getting better. The first prides I attended, people didn't even know what the pink, blue, and white flag stands for. Now most people do, and there's way more representation," end quote. So interesting stuff there.
Getting better a little bit slowly but surely, but I'm glad to see that, you know, he's right about the conversation at least shifting and people are aware of these terms now, maybe now more than ever. And, you know, we can't discount that positivity, even if we have a long way to go.
Yeah, totally. You know, I look at, oh, I'm sorry, Darren.
Go ahead.
Thing. You know, I look now even at, like, quote unquote rainbow pride flags. And if I don't see the pink and the white and the blue in there, I get a little uncomfortable. And that's why you might have seen we updated our Martinis and Murder logo this year. We had rainbow in the past, but now we have our trans and our people of color solidarity colors in there. And I think just even that little bit of extra awareness can really go a long way. You know what I mean?
I completely agree. And, you know, we've come a long way since the 60s. You know,
totally.
And it's unfortunate Marsha was sort of unable to see her work come to light, as a lot of these really progressive people do, because change takes a while. And yeah. Marsha P. Johnson's body was found floating in the Hudson River near Christopher Street Piers in New York City on July 6th, 1992. Christopher Street is obviously where Stonewall is, so right. You know, no surprise there. While her death was ruled a suicide at the time, many speculated about this being true, given the state of the LGBTQ rights at the time. And additionally, Marsha was found with, quote, a hole in her head, according to witnesses who watched her get body pulled from the river. So doesn't mean it's not a suicide, but I definitely think that it's valuable to say that description. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, you know, in that documentary I was talking about that you can watch on Netflix, you see real-time footage of people moments after, I guess, her body was pulled. And there's a guy who's, I guess you could say, an eyewitness there, and he's describing it, and he was like, you know, I'm paraphrasing here, but he's sort of describing that maybe it was a bullet hole or even blunt force trauma, and that it really didn't seem like something that looked like a suicide per se. But again, he's just a witness. He's not like, you know, a medical doctor.
And it's hard to say. But I will say, you know, friends and family do insist that Marsha was not suicidal or didn't appear to be. And there's a lot of evidence to show there were mafia ties to her death. Again, this is all speculation. Doesn't mean even if you don't think that you're suicidal, that you aren't. You know, Jean Michaels, Marsha's sister, told the Netflix documentary that she's still unaware of what happened to Marsha, saying, quote, I really don't know anything. We really don't know anything about that, end quote, which is sad and I'm sure hard to get closure. It's nice to see, though, the message that Marsha's been sending, sort of this resurrection of her, has come to fruition, which has been nice. And in the documentary, where Victoria Cruz, a transgender activist and volunteer of the New York City Anti-Violence Project, takes on Marsha's case herself, Marsha's roommate Randy Wicker insists that there's no way Marsha could have been suicidal. So these are real direct accounts from people who knew her best. Randy says, well, it certainly was not suicide. That was an insult to the family. No way could Marsha in any way commit suicide, end quote. But justice could not be served, because to many people, the police seem to just forget about Marsha's death, which I'm not surprised about. Unfortunately, that's all too common. Randy was a big outspoken critic of the police, as seen in the documentary with original footage, insisting that police just didn't care about the case because Marsha was one of many transgender people who were murdered and forgotten about. He says more recently, quote, but let's face it, the police department, they had made up their mind. The case is over with. We don't want to be bothered. This is nobody. This isn't a person. Fucking horrible. In the documentary, it's insinuated that the mafia could be responsible for the death of Marsha. And at the time of Marsha's death, there were rumors that the mafia were the ones controlling and profiting off of the gay pride parades that were new and being organized throughout the New York City area. I wouldn't be surprised if that were true. The mafia, certainly back then, you know, and Randy Wickham, Marsha's roommate, was trying to take control of the pride parade so that it was more representational of the people it was about, and not the fucking mafia.
Right.
In the documentary, Victoria Cruz discovers evidence that Randy Wicker was threatened by the mafia for trying to keep control of the pride parade as well. So it doesn't prove anything, but just instances to note for context. And all of the circumstantial evidence leads up to the same reality, which is that Marsha P. Johnson was likely murdered and her killer was just never found and no one gave a shit at the time. And according to the New York Times, quote, later in 1992, the authorities reclassified the cause to drowning from undetermined causes. And in 2012, they agreed to take a fresh look at the case, which officially remains open. So hopefully we'll get more answers.
Yeah. And just that little note there at the end about the classification, it's like, well, how do you go from suicide to drowning from undetermined causes? I mean, those are very different manners of death. And it's very clear that there's a lot of foul play included in this.
You'd think that it would at least have gone from drowning to suicide, because that seems more specific in evidence. And now they're kind of admitting that, like, yeah, we ruled at this, but we're going to go vague on it now. It's like you're admitting your own fault here.
Yeah, and one more thing I want to just clarify here, too, I think we should both kind of mention, is that the connection to the mafia is that Marsha was Randy's roommate, best friend.
Right.
And so I guess the idea, if you want to sort of make that connection, is that, you know, the theory is potentially the mafia killed off Marsha with the threat, which Victoria Cruz discovers in evidence in this documentary, you know, which was a direct message to Randy, like, don't try to take this over, or the same thing's going to happen to you that happened to her, and all these other things that are just very sadly connected.
Right.
It's worth taking a look at. It's disturbing, but it's interesting nonetheless. And yeah, I think there's a lot of ways, Darren, I think we can help allies, as gay people, as people listening to the show can help. And the HRC has great advice on their website on what we can all do to help to make transgender issues visible and not stigmatized or stereotyped. So things like supporting artists, athletes, activists, political leaders, and other transgender public figures who are sharing their stories and lived experiences. That is absolutely why I wanted Julian to weigh in on this. I think it's an extremely important thing to
Please thank him. I'm glad you spoke to him. Yeah.
And he's, by the way, a big fan of the show, so I think it was exciting for him to participate.
Well, thanks, Julian. You're the best.
Yes. And we should uplift these individuals by elevating their projects and sharing their work among your personal network and communities. We must also ensure that transgender and non-binary voices have a seat at the table where decisions are being made that impact their communities. I think that cannot go more, emphasized, I guess you could say. And raise the profile of transgender and non-binary leaders in your communities, elevate their concerns and support their work. In addition, more and more transgender and non-binary people are running for elected offices, working on their campaigns and supporting other pro-equality elected officials who are committed to addressing anti-transgender violence is imperative. So these are just some of the ways, there's tons of stuff on HRC's website that you guys can go and look, and we'll link to that in our show notes as well. Megan, if you could be sure to link it this week. Darren, there's one last thing I wanted to mention before we wrap up this very important episode. Completely ironically, in the last couple weeks, the Stonewall Inn, where we were just talking about both us having fun and where this movement began, announced that they are sort of basically kind of running out of funds amid all COVID stuff. And I did want to mention that, if you guys can, if anyone's interested rather in donating to their cause to stay in business, it's a national monument. It's the first gay historic national monument in our country. It's extremely important. I have personally donated. I wanted to just read a little bit about what they're saying here. We're reaching out because, like many families and small businesses around the world, the Stonewall Inn is struggling. Our doors have been closed for over 3 months to ensure the health, safety, and well-being of patrons, staff, and the community. Even in the best of times, it can be difficult to survive as a small business, and we now face an uncertain future. Even once we reopen, it will likely be under greatly restricted conditions, limiting our business activity. And today we're asking you to help save Stonewall. The Stonewall Inn faces an uncertain future, and we are in need of community support. The road to recovery from the COVID-19 pandemic will be long, and we need to continue to safeguard this vital piece of living history for the LGBTQ community and the global human rights movement. And we now must ask for your help to save one of the LGBTQ plus community's most iconic institutions and to keep that history alive. We're going to put a little link to the GoFundMe.
Yes, it is the Stonewall Inn Relief Fund. And we're encouraging everyone, even if it's $5, a penny, anything goes, please help save Stonewall and this iconic institution that really sparked and was the epicenter, if you will, of this movement. It's important to all of us. And John, I just wanted to say thank you so much for the research. You did such a good job. Thank you for Julian. This was such an important story to tell, and I hope we did it justice in any sort of way. And for those who don't know anything about Marsha P. Johnson, please learn, because she was truly a hero and incredible.
Such a good way to close out the show, Darren. I highly suggest anyone watch that documentary on Netflix. It's very accessible. Good. It's a good one.
Let's end on some listener shout outs just to keep it upbeat, of course. I wanted to shout out Brandy Moon in our Facebook group. She and her partner just celebrated their birthday, which is, hello, same day, which is literally the most lesbian thing that you can do, even though you're straight.
I was just going to say, is she a lesbian? I don't know.
It doesn't matter. They're doing lesbian things here, having the birthday on the same day. It's like having the same name and moving in after the first date. But happy birthday to you both, Brandy. I really appreciate you guys listening.
Darren, you're hilarious. Okay. Michelle in our Facebook group says, binging the podcast right now, up to number 80. Loving it. Many more Brits here. Hashtag dedicator. Hashtag Dan, your wife is here.
Dan, your wife's here.
Your wife is here. We haven't done that in a while. I'm glad we fit that into this episode.
Yeah, we haven't.
I did write back to Michelle and I was like, I consider myself a Spice Girl. Does that count as a Brit? Otherwise, no, I guess I'm not. I don't know.
Yeah, no, that doesn't count. You need to have the full accent. You need to have the whole thing going. You need to be tea and crumpets every freaking day. But listen, everyone, happy Pride Month.
Happy Pride.
I hope it was a good one. We're excited to see you in July. And yes, stay safe and stay healthy, everyone.
Yes, and by the way, we're all a little bit gay. Let's be honest.
Even everyone's gay.
Everyone's a little bit gay. That's a fact that we're telling you right now.
Bye, guys.
From the people who brought you The Thing About Pam, a story of fraud, power, and pride, Motive for Murder, a new Dateline podcast. Subscribe now wherever you listen.